pray. Give us ears to hear. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roland. Oh, that's loud.
I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, but a couple of weeks ago, I was in awe of Darren. A full 10 days before he was due to preach, he'd sent round his PowerPoint. He'd primed the team who were leading the service, and he had everything ready. So I resolved that I would learn from his example, and I would do the same. Long story short, I sent my PowerPoint to Pete yesterday. So thank you, Pete. Appreciate that. He's not here, is he? This morning, we're looking at the Battle of the Nine Kings in Genesis 14. It's got a couple of other titles as well. If I could have my first slide, please, James. Other titles include the Battle of the Vale of Siddim, or the Slaughter of that place. We have a catchier title to follow, so don't feel like you need to write any of those down. And I'm going to be breaking the mold a little bit because I'm not going to read the passage in its entirety on the proviso that you go home and read it this afternoon, because it's such a short passage, but there's so much to unpack in it. And the reason I'm doing that is twofold. The first is there's lots of difficult words to pronounce. And the second, more serious one, is that sometimes, and I might just be speaking for myself, when you read the Bible word for word, I sometimes lose track of the fact that this is a real event happening to real people many years ago. And sometimes I can fall into the trap of treating it a bit like a fairy story or a bit like a novel that isn't this interesting, but actually this is a real thing that happened to Abraham and the people at that time. And just to kind of help us with that, I've transposed what happened, or tried to transpose what happened, onto a modern day map so we can kind of understand where this is happening, where this is taking place. And what happens is we have five kings sort of around the Dead Sea region, and there's uprising that goes on there. And in response to this uprising, four eastern kings, the four eastern-facing, or their west-facing arrows, from sort of Kuwait, southern Iraq, and Syria region, go to try and quash these rebellions. And around the Dead Sea area, there's this big battle, the Battle of the Nine Kings. In these five kings that we've got, the point is going to work on there, you've got the kings of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, cities which I'm sure you may have heard of, but will come up later on. Go back one. And as this battle is going on, the four eastern kings plunder the five cities that they've gone to quash, and in doing so, they take away Lot, Abraham's nephew, as well as lots of other people and lots of possessions. When Abraham hears that Lot has been taken, he immediately gathers 318 trained men from his household and sets out to rescue his nephew, Abraham. And his band of brothers reach a city called Dan, which is just in sort of northern Israel. And when they get there, they stop for the night and they plot what they're going to do next. And they sort of build this plan, and then they go in and they attack the kings who have taken Lot. And what they do is they then chase them up to the further black dot, which is just near Damascus, and then they chase them on further, and they completely rout these four eastern kings, and they retrieve all of the stuff that they've taken, as well as Lot, and as well as the other hostages that they took, and they bring them back. So I hope you're still with me after that, and I guess here comes the catchier title for the note takers amongst us. The title is A Lot at Stake, Genesis 14. A trite little play on words, you think, but actually, I really feel that there's much more from this passage that we can take both in the world that we're looking at. Roland's just prayed for all of the, you know, the list of wars is endless. The list of civil wars is endless. The list of problems that our world is facing is seemingly endless. But also about how we deal with our own lives as well. How do we talk to people? How do we love people? How do we interact with people when there is a lot at stake? I really think there's so much to unpack. If you look at what's happening in Ukraine, Palestine, Congo, Myanmar, the list goes on, and then you spend 5 minutes on Twitter, you realize that everyone's an armchair expert, and you switch on the news and you've got Mr. Expert or Mrs. Expert giving their opinion on why this has happened and what series of events led up to this and what will happen next. And there's all of this sort of rhetoric that goes on, and yet at the center of it all, there is suffering. People are dying. Families are going hungry. There is a lot at stake. And at the risk of beating this trite saying to death, when we forget how much is at stake, we run the risk of harming people and hurting relationships in our own lives as well. To unpack this a little further and perhaps set the scene of what I mean, I'm going to tell two short stories, both of which involve me nearly missing a flight. That's not a common occurrence, and these were out of my control. The first one, I was traveling home from Zimbabwe with a friend, and we were due to fly from Harare to Johannesburg, and then Johannesburg on to London. As we went through security in Harare, a storm descended on the airport, and visibility was so low. And as we sat in the departure lounge, we watched our estimated time of departure get ever further away. And we only had 3 hours to play with in Johannesburg, and so that time was getting shorter and shorter, and it quickly became apparent that we were at risk of missing our flight. A friend said to me, what are we going to do? And I said, well, it's quite simple. If we do miss our flight, the airport will sort us out because it's not our fault. They'll put us up in a hotel, and then we'll fly out tomorrow evening instead. Neither of us had work to get back for, neither of us had any commitments to get back for, and actually, as we started to talk about this, I started to get a little bit excited about the prospect of staying a night in Johannesburg. We would go to the Sandton Mall, we'd buy some swimming shorts, relax by the hotel pool that was paid for by the airline. It was actually quite exciting. And then in a cruel twist of fate, our flight was called and we made it on time. Fast forward a couple of years, and Meg and I were traveling home from Zambia. We were due to stop over in Ethiopia and then fly onwards to Manchester. We stopped in Ethiopia, we had a meal, and then we went to board our gate. We beeped our boarding pass on the little scanner, and there was kind of a warning noise, and we were ushered to one side, and that was the extent of the information that was passed to us. As we stood there waiting in the rapidly emptying departure hall, I caught the unmistakable glimpse of our plane pushing back and then departing to Manchester. Without us on it. Ethiopian Airways put us up in a hotel. We had 2 nights in Ethiopia. The difference was that we were due to land back on a Sunday. Both of us had work the following Monday. Both of us were training to be teachers. We were in our last term. We both had assignments to finish. Suddenly, there's a lot more at stake. And that definitely influenced our levels of anxiety, our levels of stress when dealing with this situation. And that's the kind of difference I want to draw out when we're looking at things today. Life is different, our reactions are different, yet we need to be so careful when a lot is at stake. And I do hope none of us find ourselves in a situation where our nephews have been carried off by 4 Eastern Kings, even though this is happening around the world today when you look at the suffering that's going on. But nonetheless, I believe that Abraham gives us some handy tips for when we find ourselves in situations like this. So, this is... not that one. There we are. Abraham's Guide for When There Is a Lot at Stake. Point number one, keep calm. The 27th of October, 1962, a Russian B-59 submarine meanders its way towards a patrol up the coast of the USA. The last message received from Moscow was pretty cryptic and commanded the vessel to patrol the coast of the USA. Days had passed since the last message and there'd been no further contact with Moscow. The submarine had been able to pick up some radio signals, but these had not been particularly helpful, and then they started to hear explosions. These were only signaling charges, which were being dropped by the US Navy above to try and get the submarine to surface, but they didn't know that yet. The captain of the submarine, Valentin Savitsky, concluded that war must have broken out, they were being fired on by the US Navy, and the only plausible course of action was to fire the T-5 torpedoes the submarine had in its arsenal. These were nuclear torpedoes and would have decimated major cities, causing tens of thousands of deaths, if not more. Captain Savitsky was certain in what he needed to do, but in order to launch those torpedoes, he needed the consent of 2 other members of his crew. Ivan Maslenikov agreed that they needed to launch, and it all came down to Vasily Arkhipov. And an argument broke out amongst these 3 men, and as Arkhipov calmly tried to convince the other 2 that they should not strike, he held firm, and eventually he managed to convince them to surface the submarine, at which point they were able to contact Moscow and await further orders. The captain eventually did what Vasily Arkhipov had asked him to do, and Vasily Arkhipov is now credited with single-handedly avoiding nuclear war and the outbreak of World War III. This passage we're reading does not give us too many words, but the indication I get is that Abraham doesn't fret. He doesn't flap. He hears the news, he collects himself, and then he formulates a plan on how he is going to go about this rescue mission. So how does that help us? Does this happen because Abraham is just a cool, calm, and collected guy, nothing phases him, he's easygoing? I don't think so. I think this happens because Abraham knows the God in whom he believes and the God in whom he trusts. When the storms are swirling around his head, when everything is working against him, he does not get carried away. He does not know the fate of his nephew. He knows that he's been kidnapped. He knows that he's been taken. He does not know if he's still alive, but he does know that his God is still sovereign. He does know that his God is still on the throne. He does know that his God is still good, and he does know that his God is still watching over him. Just saying calm is pretty useless. No stressful situation has ever been dissipated by the words, keep calm. But this is a different calm. I don't believe this is a feeling of calm. I believe this is a more of a state of calm. I like to call it the but God factor. When Stephen's taken before the judges in Acts, he is asked to defend himself. And he gives a defense, and as part of it, he gives the story of Joseph. Joseph being the guy who was sold into slavery by his brothers and taken to Egypt and all of that sort of stuff. Stephen says this, because the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph, they sold him as a slave into Egypt, but God was with him and rescued him from all his troubles. Joseph was sold into slavery, but God. And this is a common reprise that we see throughout stories in the Bible. Even the Easter story, Jesus was crucified and was laid in a tomb, but God raised him. The calm in these situations that we face is not a feeling, but a sure and certain understanding that the wind and waves of life will buffet us, they will come, but God is still in control. Point number two, assemble 318 fighters. Perhaps quite not as literal as we see in the passage, but there's definitely a message in here about the power of the team that surrounds us, and that's why I've chosen to ride to Amsterdam with James Hopegill as part of my team. We recently watched the film The World Trade Center about the events that took place on September the 11th, 2001 in New York. And this film follows two police officers who were part of a squadron that were sent in to try and evacuate one of the towers while it was still burning. They gather up all their gear and they start making their way towards the staircase. They've got extra tanks for air because it's going to take them hours to get up to the people who need them. As they collect all this gear, they feel the building start to shake, more debris starts to fall, windows start to break, and then there's the unmistakable crash of the building down coming down on their heads. They rush to the elevator shaft to try and protect them because it's an empty space. Two of them make it, but the others sadly don't. And what happens is the building has fallen down on their heads. These two police officers are trapped by concrete and steel, and they're stuck. And then suddenly everything goes quiet. Everything goes dark, and it's just the two of them there, hoping that someone hears them. The whole day passes. The towers collapsed in the morning. The whole day passes, and in the evening, the search is called off. Everything goes quiet. Everything goes dark. Yet, above them in the rubble, there is a single U.S. Marine who has a torch and a conviction that he shouldn't stop looking, and he starts clambering over the rubble, shouting, if you can hear me, say something, bang something. And he does this for, I don't know how long it is, but there's a period of time where he hears nothing at all. And then the people below him hear him shouting, and they twang a little piece of metal because they've got so much dust in their lungs. And he hears it. But then he shouts again, if that was you, do that again, do that again. So they do it again. And eventually he pokes his torch through the hole and he sees these two police officers. In a moment, he gathers a team of people with hydraulic machinery, stretchers, oxygen, torches, ready to rescue these people. While he's doing that, he shouts down to them, we are Marines and you are our mission. We're coming for you. Long story short, they open up the cavity that they're in, they pull them out, they put them on a stretcher, and there's this really moving part towards the end of the film where there's a long line of people all over the rubble, and they're passing the stretcher with these men on, person to person. In that particular example, each person has their role to play. There's the guy who found them. he formulates the team. There's people who dive into the rubble and they're pulling out bits of concrete off these people's chests. There's other people who are just holding torches that the other people can see. And then right at the end, you have a long line of people, each with their own life-saving role to play, passing the stretcher to the next person to get them the medical care that they need. Each person has their role to play on this team. Each person has been chosen for a particular role. Some people are diving into the rubble, others are just holding torches. And it's important in our lives to identify those people that we can build a team with us. It might not be 318, but it might just be one person. Either way, we need those around us who can encourage us, who can build us up, who can play their part in our mission. The enemy will always seek to isolate us, and it's our responsibility to identify our 318 people and build each other up. Third point. There we are. Bring back the other people. This is a rather subtle secondary story that's happening alongside the main story. Of course, Lot is rescued, but as the passage states in verse 16, I'll go back to, he recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and the other people. And that's kind of a secondary, it's just great, Lot is back and all the other people have been brought back. But actually, when you dig into that, the ripple effect of Lot's rescue is huge on these women and other people, as the Bible describes them. They were taken off. They didn't know what their future held. And yet, Abraham's mission to rescue his nephew meant that all of these other people were liberated. All of these women and other people were free. And in orchestrating his daredevil rescue, Abraham completely changes the outcomes for all of these other people. And how we deal with the storms in our own lives has a ripple effect on those around us, on those who we may never know. My grandmother on my mum's side, my dad mentioned her last week, was a very small woman, about 4 foot tall. She used to call herself a bear of little brain, which was a drastic understatement. When they lived in Ghana, she began the children's ministry for the Church of Pentecost. The Church of Pentecost now has churches in over 60 countries and is absolutely huge. She wrote the syllabus and faithfully delivered it to a group of children when they first started the church. And then when she died in 2015, the children's ministry of the Church of Pentecost, which was still running elements of the curriculum that she'd written, had over 750,000 members, many of whom probably do not know who Margaret Mills is, but who are direct beneficiaries of her faithful completion of her mission. The storms in our lives will affect those around us, and in some cases, they'll affect generations to come. And we always want that effect to be one of grace, liberation, and one that draws people home to their loving Father, similar to Abraham's mission when he rescued Lot. So there we have it. That is Abraham's three-step guide to dealing with solutions when there is a lot at stake. Point number one, keep calm. This is not a feeling, but it is a settled conviction that no matter what is happening around us, God is still good, God is still for us, God still loves us, and God is still on our side. Point number two, assembling our army of 318. The strength of our team around us directly influences our mission and how we deal with it. And it helps us deal with the things that life throws at us. And then point number three, when you bring Lot back, remember the other people as well. Our decisions, our actions, and our plans do affect other people, do have a ripple effect. And we have the opportunity to be a life-changing, liberating force in the lives of those we come into contact with. And what a privilege that is. I'm going to close there. Thank you, Roland.